Welcome to the Guadalajara Geopolitics podcast. Today, our guest is Duncan Tucker, a British investigative journalist. He writes for UK Independent, Vice, and Al Jazeera, among others. And he links his stories to the tequilafiles.com. I recently discovered your work, and I was very impressed. Now I read your pieces as they come out. You've been based here in Guadalajara, Mexico for, I guess, half a decade now, 5 years. And, well, what's your story briefly, and how did you get into journalism and end up in Mexico?
Well, I first came here in 2009 on a study abroad program to learn Spanish, and I was studying at the University of Guadalajara. And I was here for a year, and I ended up doing an internship at a local newspaper called the Guadalajara Reporter, mm-hmm. which is an English-language weekly newspaper, which is mainly aimed at the American and Canadian expats who live in Jalisco, in Guadalajara, Chapala, Puerto Vallarta, that kind of thing. And so I went back to England to finish my studies after that, and when I graduated, they had a vacancy at the newspaper, so I flew back out here to start work with them. And I was working at the Reporter for about two and a half years, and since then I've just been working freelance, basically, with the Independent, Al Jazeera, Vice, and a few other websites.
Mm-hmm. And on your website, and as well with a lot of your articles, your focus is on Mexican current affairs. And, well, you know, oh boy, where do we begin? And so I guess, well, where would you begin, and how do you view Mexico? What issues are you most passionate about?
Well, yeah, there's certainly no shortage of material to write about here. I guess the stories I'm most passionate about are politics, human rights, social movements. Crime is always interesting. Cultural stories. I like to cover a wide range of topics. But if you want to talk about the issues and how I view Mexico, I think the one thing that kind of seeps into almost all of these issues, and it's probably at the heart of all of Mexico's problems, is the level of corruption in the country. Mm-hmm. I think that of all the political problems, it's at the heart of the drug problems, the violence here, the social stories as well. A lot of the time people are trying to overcome these issues, and then the corruption obviously inhibits the progress that can be made as well. So I think it's something that it's a very grave problem that would be extremely complex to completely solve as well. But I think it's what Mexico has to focus on, really, to make progress in any of these issues.
Well, let's take a stab at, I guess, the drug trafficking. What would you say are some of the root causes of the insecurity in Mexico related to drug trafficking? I personally believe, well, that the American Empire promotes drug trafficking, and as a result, Mexico has little power to stand up to it. Recently they showed the film Kill the Messenger about the story mm-hmm. with Gary Webb, which talks about that. And it seems, you know, it's corrupted the power structure here in some segments of society, and the corruption's become entrenched because of the riches that it brings. That's a little bit of my perspective. I don't mm-hmm. know what your take is on the drug trafficking.
Yeah, I think you're right. And that was an interesting film, actually. I watched it a couple of weeks ago, and I've been investigating that whole issue of like how the CIA became involved in the drug trafficking in the 1980s, and how that kind of led to the formation of the Guadalajara cartel, which was Mexico's first big cartel at the time. And I think ever since then, the US has had a big role in shaping the way that the conflict has gone in Mexico. But again, I think probably one of the main causes of the actual violence that's gone on for so long here is economic inequality in Mexico as well. Because at the end of the day, when you have such poverty and such huge levels of inequality, there's always poor people who have very little option. If you're living in poverty in a small town, someone comes along and gives a choice of making a lot of money by working for a drug gang or living in misery for your whole life. And if you have no education or no other prospects in life, then it's understandable how young people can become sucked into this. And then once they do get dragged into it, it's kind of like a vicious cycle where there's no real way out. I think they just descend further and further into this kind of life of crime and violence. And I think they kind of see it. I think young people, when they get dragged into this, I think they know that they're not going to live forever, but they prefer to live for 5 or 10 years as a king with money and women and whatever they want, a sense of power and a sense of importance. And I think a lot of young people from these kind of backgrounds prefer that to living a lifetime in poverty and misery. And I think that, and that, again, Mexico has to really tackle that problem of inequality as well before it can expect to see significant results in reducing the level of violence in the country.
And we saw exactly that with Chapo's second escape, and a lot of the class that you were describing. They were holding signs and protesting in support of him because people like him give money and provide work to the lower class. And I'm not sure if you saw the survey recently where, regarding his escape, most Mexicans believe the government let him out. What are your thoughts on that?
I think there's a lot of conspiracy theories out there that probably, I think beyond anything, they just reflect the deep mistrust in the Mexican government. And I think journalists as well, I think anyone that kind of really investigates this kind of thing knows that you can't trust absolutely what the government says about these kind of situations. And I don't know how far up the kind of conspiracy would have gone. I think it's beyond doubt that the prison officials at the very least must have all known about it, because it's practically impossible that he could have escaped in the way that he did without having people at the prison realize and without having them on his payroll. So the real question is, I guess, how far up did this conspiracy go? Did the people in the cabinet know? Did the president know? I think that's probably less likely, but there's very little way of being able to tell. But I think the fact that there are so many theories and they're so common in these cases, it's because the government's lied in the past. It lies frequently, and people just have absolutely no confidence in what it says anymore.
And just to go off on that tangent, as you mentioned, skepticism of the government, and you know, a lot of us living here, foreigners as well, have a lot of skepticism of the government. But I notice in other countries that's not always the case. Americans don't seem to have too much skepticism for their government. How is it with the British? And has your perception changed being in Mexico for so long regarding skepticism of the government? In general, governments in general?
I think in England there's always a slight degree of skepticism about politicians, because people just kind of see them as a bit self-serving. And I think there it's almost more people see them as incompetent rather than necessarily corrupt or that kind of thing. But it is nowhere near the level of skepticism that you see in Mexico, I don't think, just because there's... I think there's a degree of corruption in many governments all over the world, but I don't think it's as blatant as it is in Mexico. I think in the United States, for example, there's a lot of shady things that happen, but I think it's a lot more subtle than what you see in Mexico. Mm-hmm. In Mexico, there's so little repercussions for the government when they do bad things that I think they just don't really care about hiding it that much as much as a government in other countries might do. And I think people will just... they just accept it to an extent here because they know there's not much they can do about it.
And to leave the drug issue and move on to other issues. Well, you recently wrote a piece about the journalist from Veracruz killed in Mexico City. And you mentioned on average now it's one per month, which is which is insane. And we see journalists being targeted. Most of them, I guess, are Mexican for now. Do you try not to think about it, and you just do your job, or how does it affect you as a foreigner and as well as a journalist and your colleague?
I think that there is a distinction between being a foreign journalist here and being a Mexican journalist, definitely, because I think the last foreign journalist to be killed here was, I think, Brad Will in 2005 in Oaxaca. So in general, you don't get the same level of violence against foreign journalists that you do as Mexican journalists, whereas Mexican journalists are killed, like you said, there's been one a month killed this year, which is outrageous. So you do, operating here as a foreigner, you do know that you've got a bit more protection than a local journalist. But at the same time, obviously, you have to take certain precautions. You have to be sensible about what you do. And it's not just yourself that you have to think about. You have to think about maybe your sources or the people that you're talking to or the Mexicans who may be at more risk than yourself as a result of what you actually report. So there is always a concern there. And I think it's generally just a case of kind of applying a degree of common sense to what you do, but I mean, there are obviously risks, yeah.
And, you know, this is just a sign now, as you write, one per month is being assassinated or murdered. And it seems, you know, the corruption seems to be getting worse. And I think it's kind of depressing sometimes for those of us that live here. And I think it's dangerous for society to tolerate it, because it becomes normal behavior. And then it just goes downward, in a spiral downward, you know, another level. What helps you to kind of, you know, get through the day hearing of all of these things?
Well, I think, like you say, it's important that people know about this kind of thing. So I think you do feel a sense of duty to report on it, even if it is depressing. Sometimes Mexicans, like friends of mine, have asked me, you know, why do you always write bad things about our country? And it's not that I have anything against Mexico. I love Mexico. I think it's an amazing country. But if you ignore these things, and if you don't report on them, and if you don't make people aware of them in other countries, then there's absolutely no pressure on the government to go about fixing these things, or on other social areas of society to start fixing these kinds of things. So I think the awareness and the kind of watchdog role of the media is absolutely crucial to any hope that Mexico can start to improve and start to tackle these issues. So I think there is it's a very important job for people to be doing here, and I think you do get kind of depressed sometimes, or even desensitized to some extent to the things you write about, because things that would be like an incredible, unbelievable story in another country almost become commonplace here in Mexico. And it does affect, I think, your perception of it after a while. You kind of become, I guess, desensitized to it. But I think you always have to keep in mind the importance of what you're writing about, and how that can hopefully lead to some degree of change in Mexico in the future.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you, because we need people pushing back towards the corruption in society. You know, that's one reason I do this podcast and share it with students here, which, you know, I always, we have to, and wherever we are, you know, I'm here in education trying to influence them so that they can influence others, right? Mm-hmm. And the ripple effect. And what other issues? You know, recently you wrote about Luz del Mundo for the UK Independent. Mm-hmm. There's all this stuff about Uber going on. Are there any other issues that you'd like to comment on?
One story I'm working on at the moment, actually, is about the disappearances in here in Jalisco State. It's a massive issue, this, which has been largely overlooked, especially by the international press. At the moment, officially, the Mexican government says there's 26,000 missing people across the entire country, and about 2,000 of them are just here in Jalisco, although the kind of investigative reporters I've spoken to have spent years studying this say the number is actually a lot higher than the amount the government says here. But I think there are changes afoot at the moment. Like Jalisco has just replaced the Attorney General, and the guy who's coming in his place has kind of made it a priority to start solving these cases, and he's going to personally lead the kind of task force to try and find some of these people. But once I started talking to all these family members who have lost sons, fathers, daughters, is a terrifying issue. I think there's few things worse than hearing a parent who's lost their child, especially because when they disappear, there's not even a sense of closure that you might get if they were actually killed. There's just a sense of not knowing, which can go on for years. There's a local organization here in Jalisco of families that have come together who have all, they've all got missing relatives here in Jalisco. And I think there's something like 350 of them, and not one of their cases has been solved. They've been going on for years. So they've been trying to pressure the government to take them seriously and to implement new measures, which it does look like they are starting to make some positive changes. And the governor agreed to meet with them recently after 2 months of ignoring the issue. He met with them, and they have been working together since then. So it does look like there's a slight level of improvement. But to give you a sense of the scale of the problem, up until last year, I think they had 2 police officers in the entire state who were assigned to solving these disappearances, when there's something like 2,000 people missing in the whole of Jalisco. I think that was doubled to 4, and now it's gone up to about 16 or something, which is obviously an improvement, but it's still not that many people to be working on an issue of this magnitude. I think for a long time it wasn't a priority for the authority to, which is obviously really depressing when you speak to these people their struggle every single day is just thinking about where their missing relative is and how they can find them and what they can do about it. And I think a lot of them have given up hope that the authorities can help them, and they try to find them by their own means, but there's a real sense of kind of impotence and desperation there.
And it's, you know, it's almost like living in a war zone, unfortunately, because you never know what's going to happen. As you say, you know, you never know if your child's going to be kidnapped or if you're going to be assaulted or, you know, 2 months ago here in Guadalajara, we had the narco blockades, and, you know, 5 minutes from where I live, they burned a bus. And you walk around a little paranoid because you get, you know, you experience these things and you just never know what's going to happen next.
Yeah, I think there's a real sense of uncertainty here at the moment, especially as a result of the violence that we've seen in Jalisco in the last few months. It had always been kind of one of the more stable states in Mexico. It didn't see the same degree of drug violence that you see in the northern border states or in neighboring Michoacán or Guerrero or places like that. But since the government's gone after many of the biggest drug cartels, the Jalisco Nueva Generación cartel has actually become one of the most powerful organizations in the whole of the country now. And we've seen in the last few months, I think from around March, April kind of time, they've been openly attacking the state. They've been ambushing police patrols. They killed 15 officers in one ambush. Then they shot down a helicopter, a special forces helicopter, the same day as they blockaded, I think it was 39 roads across the state of Jalisco and the neighboring states, the narco blockades that you mentioned. So I think people don't really know what to expect now. There's been a bit of a lull since then, but then there's a widespread concern now that with the escape of El Chapo, that this could lead to a kind of turf war between the Sinaloa cartel and the Nueva Generación, because they were former allies, but now there's no one's quite sure what their relationship is right now. But it's a bit ambiguous. But in the past, when El Chapo has been faced with powerful rivals, he's gone after them pretty hard, as you've seen in Tijuana and Ciudad Juarez and the northeast of the country where the Zetas. So there's this kind of fear at the moment that he could go after the Nueva Generación right now, which would prove disastrous for everyone involved, basically.
And what are your realistic forecasts, I guess? You know, we all have our ideals. We all hope that, you know, this would just end and we could live happily ever after. Those are our hopes. Mm-hmm. But realistically, what do you think? Which way are we trending toward here?
I think if the Jalisco cartel does anything else like what it has done in the last few months, I think the government will go after it hard and they'll probably end up arresting the leader. Because we have seen in the last year, the current government has quite a strong record of bringing down the heads of each cartel, even with El Chapo's escape. They have brought down the heads of the Knights Templar, the Zetas, the Gulf cartel, the Tijuana cartel. And I think a lot of journalists I've spoken to here believe that the former attorney general had been corrupted, and that he'd been protecting the Nueva Generación cartel. But with him being replaced as well, I think is a sign that the government is going to take them more seriously and is going to try and bring them down. And I don't think they can afford to let them carry on being so bold and aggressive, because it damages Mexico's image. I mean, Guadalajara is the second biggest city in the country. It's a business capital. They're always talking about the level of investment here, and you're not going to get investors if people are burning buses every week. So I think the government can't really afford to let it get that bad.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
With regard to the possibility of a kind of turf war with the Sinaloa cartel, I don't think there hasn't really been any evidence of that since El Chapo's escape, but there's a lot of speculation. But I think that's just a matter of waiting to see how it pans out. I don't think there's much you can really forecast there.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't have been surprised if the higher up in government was corrupted. I just saw a few days ago Cartel Land. I'm not sure if you've seen that documentary.
I haven't seen it yet. I've seen the trailer and it looks good. I'm very much looking forward to seeing it, but I haven't had the opportunity yet.
Yeah, they mentioned, you know, that came out this year, and one of the main figures documented, I guess now he's in jail, and one of the mayors depicted in the documentary early on and was caught later recently, there's a video of him talking with drug leaders. So, you know, it's the same old story. What advice would you give to aspiring journalists regarding the trade?
I think experience is key when you're young. I think, like, I had the choice of kind of either staying in England and trying to gradually build my way up at like a local small town newspaper where not much happens, and kind of starting right at the bottom of the ladder. And so I decided to go abroad and just try and, I think there's more opportunities abroad. I think there's more interesting things to write about as well. And I think just going out there and doing something and just trying to find a kind of niche in the market is a good way to get started and get experience. Like the local newspaper I worked out here was quite a small operation, but it was a fantastic place to learn the ropes, like whilst working at the same time, rather than paying necessarily for an expensive master's degree or something like that. And once you kind of build up that experience and write a few articles and get your name out there and learn the basics, then you can kind of gradually go about getting your name or getting articles in bigger media organizations. And it's a constant learning process. I'm still learning a huge amount every day. Like almost every article that I write, you'll always find ways that you can improve it and things that you can do better. And meeting and talking to other journalists is crucial as well. Like most journalists are extremely friendly and happy to provide advice. And I think it always helps a huge amount to have someone that can kind of point you in the right direction or give you feedback and that kind of thing.
And so you say go to where the action is, and I couldn't agree more with you. And that was interesting. We mentioned Kill the Messenger and Gary Webb, you know, he went to where the action was, and then finally they wanted to put him in a small town paper, and he just couldn't deal with that.
Yeah, I think after the kind of buzz that you get from writing about important issues and kind of major events to then go to a small town place that, what was he writing about? Was it horses that had diarrhea or something?
Yeah.
Complete non-issue or something. And it's a kind of a depressing contrast to then to go from that level to then go to writing about something completely irrelevant.
Yeah, that was, I mean, I guess amusing, but yeah, sad. And what are your thoughts on Vice and working for them, writing for them? They seem to have exploded. I think I was following them from the beginning when years ago when they were quite small. And what are your thoughts on just looking at what's happening with Vice?
I really enjoy writing for Vice. One of the things I like about them is the depth of their coverage. I think they publish probably one or two articles about Mexico every single day, which is a lot more than almost any other foreign media outlet that operates here. They have a great team in their bureau in Mexico City, but they also use freelancers a lot. So like, if something happens in a certain part of the country, they'll have someone who can write about it there. Like, for example, when something happens in Guadalajara or Jalisco, I'll be the one that tends to write about it. And I'm really impressed with their coverage in general. Since before I started working for them, I'd noticed that I think, for example, when the students disappeared last year from Ayotzinapa, their coverage of it was probably better than anyone else's. They did a great documentary on the issue. And I think they're just, I think they're probably the strongest foreign media outlet operating in Mexico today. Other than that, yeah, their expansion has been impressive. I only really started following them since I moved here. I didn't really know much about them before. And then in other countries, I think like in England, they have this kind of hipster type of image, kind of, and maybe in the United States as well, where it's not really tackling serious issues as much. But I think their foreign reporting at least has become something to aspire to.
Yeah, it's really impressive. I mean, they go where other organizations don't go. You know, they did a short documentary on the Muslims in living in Mexico, which, you know, it's interesting to know about it. You don't really see any, and you know, there's like 5,000 of them, the biggest community that lives down in Chiapas or so, somewhere like that, and just stuff no one's talking about and you want to know and learn about.
That's one of the things I do as a reporter. I try to find issues that haven't been completely done to death. So I think there's so many interesting things that happen here that get overlooked, especially being outside of Mexico City. I think sometimes the media is a bit capital centric in any country, so it's always good to to have someone that supports you if you want to try and do a story on something that's less well known or something that hasn't really been covered before.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. That's the way to go. And do you have any final comments or words of wisdom, as I always ask, for the next generation looking to do good in the world, whether by journalism or any other trade? Any final comments or advice, tips?
I'm not sure I'm that qualified to give that much advice, but I think it's just a matter of sticking to your principles and having a bit of self-belief and determination. And I think if whatever goal you decide to set yourself, whatever way you think you can create some kind of improvement in the world, then you just have to go for it and stick to your guns. And I think I don't see why anyone can't achieve whatever their main goal is, really.
Okay, well, Duncan Tucker, thank you for your time and for your insights. You write your articles are posted to your blog, I believe, the tequilafiles.com, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And people can follow you on Twitter, I think. It's, well, Duncan Tucker at Twitter.
Yep.
Well, thanks for your time.